Understanding contains the laws of correct thinking upon a particular class of objects. The former may be called elemental logic, the latter the organon of this or that particular science. The latter is for the most part employed in the schools as a propedeutic to the sciences, although, indeed, according to the course of human reason, it is the last thing we arrive at, when the science has been already matured, and needs only the finishing touches towards its correction and completion. For our knowledge of the objects of our attempted science must be tolerably extensive and complete before we can indicate the laws by which a science of these objects can be established. General logic is again either pure or applied. In the former, we abstract all the empirical conditions under which the understanding is exercised. For example, the influence of the senses, the play of the fantasy or imagination, the laws of the memory, the force of habit, of inclination, etc. Consequently, also, the sources of prejudice. In a word, we abstract all causes from which particular cognitions arise, because these causes regard the understanding under certain circumstances of its application, and to the knowledge of them experience is required. Pure general logic has to do, therefore, merely with pure a priori principles, and is a canon of understanding and reason, but only in respect of the formal part of their use, be the content what it may, empirical or transcendental. General logic is called applied when it is directed to the laws of the use of the understanding, under the subjective empirical conditions which psychology teaches us. It has, therefore, empirical principles, although at the same time it is in so far general that it applies to the exercise of the understanding without regard to the difference of objects. On this account, moreover, it is neither a canon of the understanding in general, nor an organon of a particular science, but merely a cathartic of the human understanding. In general logic, therefore, that part which constitutes pure logic must be carefully distinguished from that which constitutes applied, though still general logic. The former alone is properly science, although short and dry, as the methodical exposition of an elemental doctrine of the understanding ought to be. In this, therefore, logicians must always bear in mind two rules. 1. As general logic, it makes abstraction of all content of the cognition of the understanding and of the difference of objects, and has to do with nothing but the mere form of thought. 2. As pure logic, it has no empirical principles, and consequently draws nothing, contrary to the common persuasion, from psychology, which therefore has no influence on the canon of the understanding. It is a demonstrated doctrine, and everything in it must be certain completely a priori. What I called applied logic, contrary to the common acceptation of this term, according to which it should contain certain exercises for the scholar, for which pure logic gives the rules, is a representation of the understanding and of the rules of its necessary employment in concreto, that is to say, under the accidental conditions of the subject, which may either hinder or promote this employment, and which are all given only empirically. Thus, applied logic treats of attention, its impediments and consequences, of the origin of error, of the state of doubt, hesitation, conviction, etc., and to it is related pure general logic in the same way that pure morality, which contains only the necessary moral laws of free will, is related to practical ethics, which considers these laws under all the impediments of feelings, inclinations, and passions to which men are more or less subjected, and which never can furnish us with a true and demonstrated science, because it, as well as applied logic, requires empirical and psychological principles. 2. Of transcendental logic. General logic, as we have seen, makes abstraction of all content of cognition, that is, of all relation of cognition to its object, and regards only the logical form in the relation of cognitions to each other, that is, the form of thought in general. But as we have both pure and empirical intuitions, as transcendental aesthetic proves, in like manner a distinction might be drawn between pure and empirical thought of objects. In this case, there would exist a kind of logic in which we should not make abstraction of all content of cognition. For logic, which should comprise merely the laws of pure thought of an object, would of course exclude all these cognitions which were of empirical content. This kind of logic would also examine the origin of our cognitions of objects, so far as that origin cannot be ascribed to the objects themselves, while on the contrary, general logic has nothing to do with the origin of our cognitions, but contemplates our representations, be they given primitively a priori in ourselves, or be they only of empirical origin, solely according to the laws which the understanding observes in employing them in the process of thought in relation to each other. Consequently, general logic treats of the form of the understanding only, which can be applied to representations from whatever source they may have arisen. And here I shall make a remark which the reader must bear well in mind in the course of the following considerations, to wit, that not every cognition a priori, but only those through which we cognize that and how certain representations, intuitions or conceptions, are applied or are possible only a priori. That is to say, that a priori possibility of cognition and the a priori use of it are transcendental. Therefore, neither is space, nor any a priori geometrical determination of space, a transcendental representation, but only the knowledge that such a representation is not of empirical origin, and the possibility of its relating to objects of experience, though itself a priori, can be called transcendental. So also the application of space to objects in general would be transcendental, but if it be limited to objects of sense, it is empirical. Thus, the distinction of the transcendental and empirical belongs only to the critique of cognitions, and does not concern the relation of these to their object. Accordingly, in the expectation that there may perhaps be conceptions which relate a priori to objects, not as pure or sensuous intuitions, but merely as acts of pure thought, which are therefore conceptions, but neither of empirical nor aesthetical origin, in this expectation, I say, we form to ourselves, by anticipation, the idea of a science of pure understanding and rational cognition, by means of which we may cogitate objects entirely a priori. A science of this kind, which should determine the origin, the extent, and the objective validity of such cognitions, must be called transcendental logic, because it has not, like general logic, to do with the laws of understanding and reason in relation to empirical as well as pure rational cognitions without distinction, but concerns itself with these only in an a priori relation to objects. 3. Of the division of general logic into analytic and dialectic. The old question with which people sought to push logicians into a corner so that they must either have recourse to pitiful sophisms or confess their ignorance, and consequently the vanity of their whole art, is this: what is truth? The definition of the word truth, to wit, the accordance of the cognition with its object, is presupposed in the question. But we desire to be told, in the answer to it, what is the universal and secure criterion of the truth of every cognition. To know what questions we may reasonably propose is, in itself, a strong evidence of sagacity and intelligence. For if a question be in itself absurd and unsusceptible of a rational answer, it is attended with the danger, not to mention the shame that falls upon the person who proposes it, of seducing the unguarded listener into making absurd answers, and we are presented with the ridiculous spectacle of one, as the ancients said, milking the he-goat, and the other holding a sieve. If truth consists in the accordance of a cognition with its object, this object must be, ipso facto, distinguished from all others. For a cognition is false if it does not accord with the object to which it relates, although it contains something which may be affirmed of other objects. Now, an universal criterion of truth would be that which is valid for all cognitions, without distinction of their objects. But it is evident that since, in the case of such a criterion, we make abstraction of all the content of a cognition, that is, of all relation to its object, and truth relates precisely to this content, it must be utterly absurd to ask for a mark of the truth of this content of cognition. And that, accordingly, a sufficient and at the same time universal test of truth cannot possibly be found. As we have already termed the content of a cognition its matter, we shall say, of the truth of our cognitions in respect of their matter, no universal test can be demanded, because such a demand is self-contradictory. On the other hand, with regard to our cognition in respect of its mere form, excluding all content, it is equally manifest that logic, insofar as it exhibits the universal and necessary laws of the understanding, must in these very laws present us with criteria of truth. Whatever contradicts these rules is false, because thereby the understanding is made to contradict its own universal laws of thought, that is, to contradict itself. These criteria, however, apply solely to the form of truth, that is, of thought in general, and in so far they are perfectly accurate, yet not sufficient. For although a cognition may be perfectly accurate as to logical form, that is, not self-contradictory, it is notwithstanding quite possible that it may not stand in agreement with its object. Consequently, the merely logical criterion of truth, namely, the accordance of a cognition with the universal and formal laws of understanding and reason, is nothing more than the conditio sine qua non, or negative condition of all truth. Farther than this, logic cannot go, and the error which depends not on the form, but on the content of the cognition, it has no test to discover. General logic, then, resolves the formal business of understanding and reason into its elements, and exhibits them as principles of all logical judging of our cognitions. This part of logic may therefore be called analytic, and is at least the negative test of truth, because all cognitions must first of all be estimated and tried according to these laws before we proceed to investigate them in respect of their content, in order to discover whether they contain positive truth in regard to their object. Because, however, the mere form of a cognition, accurately as it may accord with logical laws, is insufficient to supply us with material, objective truth, no one, by means of logic alone, can venture to predicate anything of, or decide concerning objects, unless he has obtained, independently of logic, well-grounded information about them, in order afterwards to examine, according to logical laws, into the use and connection in a cohering whole of that information, or, what is still better, merely to test it by them. Notwithstanding, there lies so seductive a charm in the possession of a specious art like this, an art which gives to all our cognitions the form of the understanding, although with respect to the content thereof we may be sadly deficient, that general logic, which is merely a canon of judgment, has been employed as an organon for the actual production, or rather, for the semblance of production of objective assertions, and has thus been grossly misapplied. Now, general logic, in its assumed character of organon, is called dialectic. Different as are the significations in which the ancients used this term for a science or an art, we may safely infer from their actual employment of it that with them it was nothing else than a logic of illusion, a sophistical art for giving ignorance, nay, even intentional sophistries, the colouring of truth, in which the thoroughness of procedure which logic requires was imitated and their topic employed to cloak the empty pretensions. Now it may be taken as a safe and useful warning that general logic, considered as an organon, must always be a logic of illusion, that is, be dialectical, for as it teaches us nothing whatever respecting the content of our cognitions, but merely the formal conditions of their accordance with the understanding, which do not relate to and are quite indifferent in respect of objects, any attempt to employ it as an instrument, organon, in order to extend and enlarge the range of our knowledge, must end in mere prating. Anyone being able to maintain or oppose, with some appearance of truth, any single assertion whatever. Such instruction is quite unbecoming the dignity of philosophy. For these reasons, we have chosen to denominate this part of logic dialectic, in the sense of a critique of dialectical illusion, and we wish the term to be so understood in this place. 4. Of the division of transcendental logic into transcendental, analytic, and dialectic. In transcendental logic, we isolate the understanding, as in transcendental aesthetic, the sensibility, and select from our cognition merely that part of thought which has its origin in the understanding alone. The exercise of this pure cognition, however, depends upon this as its condition, that objects to which it may be applied be given to us in intuition. For without intuition, the whole of our cognition is without objects, and is therefore quite void. That part of transcendental logic, then, which treats of the elements of pure cognition of the understanding, and of the principles without which no object at all can be thought, is transcendental analytic, and at the same time a logic of truth. For no cognition can contradict it without losing at the same time all content, that is, losing all reference to an object, and therefore all truth. But because we are very easily seduced into employing these pure cognitions and principles of the understanding by themselves, and that even beyond the boundaries of experience, which yet is the only source whence we can obtain matter, objects, on which these pure conditions may be employed, understanding runs the risk of making, by means of empty sophisms, a material and objective use of the mere formal principles of the pure understanding, and of passing judgments on objects without distinction, objects which are not given to us, nay, perhaps cannot be given to us in any way. Now, as it ought properly to be only a canon for judging of the empirical use of the understanding, this kind of logic is misused when we seek to employ it as an organon of the universal and unlimited exercise of the understanding, and attempt with the pure understanding alone to judge synthetically, affirm and determine respecting objects in general. In this case, the exercise of the pure understanding becomes dialectical. The second part of our transcendental logic must therefore be a critique of dialectical illusion, and this critique we shall term transcendental dialectic, not meaning it as an art of producing dogmatically such illusion, an art which is unfortunately too current among the practitioners of metaphysical juggling, but as a critique of understanding and reason in regard to their hyperphysical use. This critique will expose the groundless nature of the pretensions of these two faculties, and invalidate their claims to the discovery and enlargement of our cognitions merely by means of transcendental principles, and show that the proper employment of these faculties is to test the judgments made by the pure understanding, and to guard it from sophistical delusion. Transcendental Logic. First Division. Transcendental Analytic. SS 1. Transcendental analytic is the dissection of the whole of our a priori knowledge into the elements of the pure cognition of the understanding. In order to effect our purpose, it is necessary, 1, that the conceptions be pure and not empirical, 2, that they belong not to intuition and sensibility, but to thought and understanding, 3, that they be elementary conceptions, and as such, quite different from deduced or compound conceptions, 4, that our table of these elementary conceptions be complete and fill up the whole sphere of the pure understanding. Now this completeness of a science cannot be accepted with confidence on the guarantee of a mere estimate of its existence in an aggregate formed only by means of repeated experiments and attempts. The completeness which we require is possible only by means of an idea of the totality of the a priori cognition of the understanding, and through the thereby determined division of the conceptions which form the said whole, consequently only by means of their connection in a system. Pure understanding distinguishes itself not merely from everything empirical, but also completely from all sensibility. It is a unity self-subsistent, self-sufficient, and not to be enlarged by any additions from without. Hence, the sum of its cognition constitutes a system to be determined by and comprised under an idea, and the completeness and articulation of this system can at the same time serve as a test of the correctness and genuineness of all the parts of cognition that belong to it. The whole of this part of transcendental logic consists of two books, of which the one contains the conceptions and the other the principles of pure understanding. Book 1. SS 2. Analytic of Conceptions. By the term analytic of conceptions, I do not understand the analysis of these, or the usual process in philosophical investigations of dissecting the conceptions which present themselves according to their content, and so making them clear. But I mean the hitherto little attempted dissection of the faculty of understanding itself, in order to investigate the possibility of conceptions a priori by looking for them in the understanding alone as their birthplace, and analyzing the pure use of this faculty. For this is the proper duty of a transcendental philosophy. What remains is the logical treatment of the conceptions in philosophy in general. We shall therefore follow up the pure conceptions even to their germs and beginnings in the human understanding, in which they lie until they are developed on occasions presented by experience, and freed by the same understanding from the empirical conditions attaching to them, are set forth in their unalloyed purity. Chapter 1. Of the Transcendental Clue to the Discovery of All Pure Conceptions of the Understanding. SS 3. Introductory. When we call into play a faculty of cognition, different conceptions manifest themselves according to the different circumstances, and make known this faculty, and assemble themselves into a more or less extensive collection, according to the time or penetration that has been applied to the consideration of them. Where this process, conducted as it is mechanically, so to speak, will end, cannot be determined with certainty. Besides, the conceptions which we discover in this haphazard manner present themselves by no means in order and systematic unity, but are at last coupled together only according to resemblances to each other, and arranged in series according to the quantity of their content, from the simpler to the more complex. Series which are anything but systematic, though not altogether without a certain kind of method in their construction. Transcendental philosophy has the advantage, and moreover the duty, of searching for its conceptions according to a principle, because these conceptions spring pure and unmixed out of the understanding as an absolute unity, and therefore must be connected with each other according to one conception or idea. A connection of this kind, however, furnishes us with a ready-prepared rule by which its proper place may be assigned to every pure conception of the understanding, and the completeness of the system of all be determined a priori, both which would otherwise have been dependent on mere choice or chance. SS 4. Section 1. Of defined above use of understanding in general. The understanding was defined above only negatively, as a non-sensuous faculty of cognition. Now, independently of sensibility, we cannot possibly have any intuition. Consequently, the understanding is no faculty of intuition. But besides intuition, there is no other mode of cognition, except through conceptions. Consequently, the cognition of every, at least of every human understanding, is a cognition through conceptions. Not intuitive, but discursive. All intuitions, as sensuous, depend on affections. Conceptions, therefore, upon functions. By the word function, I understand the unity of the act of arranging diverse representations under one common representation. Conceptions, then, are based on the spontaneity of thought, as sensuous intuitions are on the receptivity of impressions. Now, the understanding cannot make any other use of these conceptions than to judge by means of them. As no representation, except an intuition, relates immediately to its object, a conception never relates immediately to an object, but only to some other representation thereof, be that an intuition or itself a conception. A judgment, therefore, is the mediate cognition of an object, consequently the representation of a representation of it. In every judgment there is a conception which applies to, and is valid for many other conceptions, and which among these comprehends also a given representation, this last being immediately connected with an object. For example, in the judgment, all bodies are divisible, our conception of divisible applies to various other conceptions. Among these, however, it is here particularly applied to the conception of body, and this conception of body relates to certain phenomena which occur to us. These objects, therefore, are mediately represented by the conception of divisibility. All judgments, accordingly, are functions of unity in our representations, inasmuch as, instead of an immediate, a higher representation, which comprises this and various others, is used for our cognition of the object, and thereby many possible cognitions are collected into one. But we can reduce all acts of the understanding to judgments, so that understanding may be represented as the faculty of judging. For it is, according to what has been said above, a faculty of thought. Now thought is cognition by means of conceptions. But conceptions, as predicates of possible judgments, relate to some representation of a yet undetermined object. Thus, the conception of body indicates something, for example metal, which can be cognized by means of that conception. It is, therefore, a conception for the reason alone that other representations are contained under it, by means of which it can relate to objects. It is, therefore, the predicate to a possible judgment. For example, every metal is a body. All the functions of the understanding, therefore, can be discovered when we completely exhibit the functions of unity in judgments, and that this may be effected very easily, the following section will show. SS 5, Section 2, of the logical function of the understanding in judgments. If we abstract all the content of a judgment and consider only the intellectual form thereof, we find that the function of thought in a judgment can be brought under four heads, of which each contains three momenta. These may be conveniently represented in the following table. 1. Quantity of judgments. Universal, particular, singular. 2. Quality. Affirmative, negative, infinite. 3. Relation. Categorical, hypothetical, disjunctive. 4. Modality, problematical, assertorical, apodeictical. As this division appears to differ in some, though not essential points, from the usual technique of logicians, the following observations for the prevention of otherwise possible misunderstanding will not be without their use. 1. Logicians say, with justice, that in the use of judgments in syllogisms, singular judgments may be treated like universal ones. For, precisely because a singular judgment has no extent at all, its predicate cannot refer to a part of that which is contained in the conception of the subject and be excluded from the rest. The predicate is valid for the whole conception, just as if it were a general conception, and had extent to the whole of which the predicate applied. On the other hand, let us compare a singular with a general judgment, merely as a cognition, in regard to quantity. The singular judgment relates to the general one as unity to infinity, and is therefore in itself essentially different. Thus, if we estimate a singular judgment, judicium singulare, not merely according to its intrinsic validity as a judgment, but also as a cognition generally, according to its quantity in comparison with that of other cognitions, it is then entirely different from a general judgment, judicium commune, and in a complete table of the momenta of thought deserves a separate place. Though indeed, this would not be necessary in a logic limited merely to the consideration of the use of judgments in reference to each other. 2. In like manner, in transcendental logic, infinite must be distinguished from affirmative judgments, although in general logic they are rightly enough classed under affirmative. General logic abstracts all content of the predicate, though it be negative, and only considers whether the said predicate be affirmed or denied of the subject. But transcendental logic considers also the worth or content of this logical affirmation, an affirmation by means of a merely negative predicate, and inquires how much the sum total of our cognition gains by this affirmation. For example, if I say of the soul, "It is not mortal," by this negative judgment, I should at least ward off error. Now, by the proposition, "the soul is not mortal," I have, in respect of the logical form, really affirmed, inasmuch as I thereby place the soul in the unlimited sphere of immortal beings. Now, because of the whole sphere of possible existences, the mortal occupies one part and the immortal the other, neither more nor less is affirmed by the proposition than that the soul is one among the infinite multitude of things which remain over when I take away the whole mortal part. But by this proceeding we accomplish only this much, that the infinite sphere of all possible existences is in so far limited that the mortal is excluded from it, and the soul is placed in the remaining part of the extent of this sphere. But this part remains, notwithstanding this exception, infinite, and more parts may be taken away from the whole sphere, without in the slightest degree thereby augmenting or affirmatively determining our conception of the soul. These judgments, therefore, infinite in respect of their logical extent, are, in respect of the content of their cognition, merely limitative. and are consequently entitled to a place in our transcendental table of all the momenta of thought in judgments, because the function of the understanding exercised by them may perhaps be of importance in the field of its pure a priori cognition. 3. All relations of thought in judgments are those, A, of the predicate to the subject, B, of the principle to its consequence, C, of the divided cognition and all the members of the division to each other. In the first of these three classes, we consider only two conceptions. In the second, two judgments. In the third, several judgments in relation to each other. The hypothetical proposition, if perfect justice exists, the obstinately wicked are punished, contains properly the relation to each other of two propositions, namely, perfect justice exists, and the obstinately wicked are punished. Whether these propositions are in themselves true is a question not here decided. Nothing is cogitated by means of this judgment except a certain consequence. Finally, the disjunctive judgment contains a relation of two or more propositions to each other, a relation not of consequence but of logical opposition, insofar as the sphere of the one proposition excludes that of the other. But it contains at the same time a relation of community insofar as all the propositions taken together fill up the sphere of the cognition. The disjunctive judgment contains therefore the relation of the parts of the whole sphere of a cognition, since the sphere of each part is a complemental part of the sphere of the other, each contributing to form the sum total of the divided cognition. Take, for example, the proposition, the world exists either through blind chance or through internal necessity or through an external cause. Each of these propositions embraces a part of the sphere of our possible cognition as to the existence of a world, all of them taken together, the whole sphere. To take the cognition out of one of these spheres is equivalent to placing it in one of the others. And, on the other hand, to place it in one sphere is equivalent to taking it out of the rest. There is, therefore, in a distinctive judgment, a certain community of cognitions, which consists in this, that they mutually exclude each other, yet thereby determine as a whole the true cognition, inasmuch as, taken together, they make up the complete content of a particular given cognition. And this is all that I find necessary for the sake of what follows to remark in this place. 4. The modality of judgments is a quite peculiar function, with this distinguishing characteristic, that it contributes nothing to the content of a judgment, for besides quantity, quality, and relation, there is nothing more that constitutes the content of a judgment, but concerns itself only with the value of the copula in relation to thought in general. Problematical judgments are those in which the affirmation or negation is accepted as merely possible, ad libitum. In the assertorical, we regard the proposition as real, true. In the apodeictical, we look on it as necessary. See footnote. Thus, the two judgments, antecedens et consequens, the relation of which constitutes a hypothetical judgment, likewise those, the members of the division, in whose reciprocity the disjunctive consists, are only problematical. In the example above given, the proposition, there exists perfect justice, is not stated assertorically, but as an ad libitum judgment, which someone may choose to adopt, and the consequence alone is assertorical. Hence such judgments may be obviously false, and yet, taken problematically, be conditions of our cognition of the truth. Thus the proposition, the world exists only by blind chance, is in the disjunctive judgment of problematical import only. That is to say, one may accept it for the moment, and it helps us, like the indication of the wrong road among all the roads that one can take, to find out the true proposition. The problematical proposition is, therefore, that which expresses only logical possibility, which is not objective. That is, it expresses a free choice to admit the validity of such a proposition, a merely arbitrary reception of it into the understanding. The assertorical speaks of logical reality or truth, as, for example, in a hypothetical syllogism, the antecedens presents itself in a problematical form in the major, in an assertorical form in the minor, and it shows that the proposition is in harmony with the laws of the understanding. The apodeictical proposition cogitates the assertorical as determined by these very laws of the understanding, consequently as affirming a priori, and in this manner it expresses logical necessity. Now, because all is here gradually incorporated with the understanding, inasmuch as in the first place we judge problematically, then accept assertorically our judgment as true. Lastly, affirm it as inseparably united with the understanding, that is, as necessary and apodeictical. We may safely reckon these three functions of modality as so many momenta of thought. Footnote. Just as if thought were in the first instance a function of the understanding, in the second of judgment, in the third of reason. A remark which will be explained in the sequel. SS 6. Section 3. Of the pure conceptions of the understanding, or categories. General logic, as has been repeatedly said, makes abstraction of all content of cognition, and expects to receive representations from some other quarter, in order, by means of analysis, to convert them into conceptions. On the contrary, transcendental logic has lying before it the manifold content of a priori sensibility, which transcendental aesthetic presents to it in order to give matter to the pure conceptions of the understanding, without which transcendental logic would have no content, and be therefore utterly void. Now space and time contain an infinite diversity of determinations of pure a priori intuition, but are nevertheless the condition of the mind's receptivity, under which alone it can obtain representations of objects, and which, consequently, must always affect the conception of these objects. But the spontaneity of thought requires that this diversity be examined after a certain manner, received into the mind and connected in order afterwards to form a cognition out of it. This process I call synthesis. By the word synthesis, in its most general signification, I understand the process of joining different representations to each other and of comprehending their diversity in one cognition. This synthesis is pure when the diversity is not given empirically but a priori, as that in space and time. Our representations must be given previously to any analysis of them, and no conceptions can arise, quo ad their content, analytically. But the synthesis of a diversity, be it given a priori or empirically, is the first requisite for the production of a cognition, which in its beginning, indeed, may be crude and confused, and therefore in need of analysis. Still, synthesis is that by which alone the elements of our cognition are collected and united into a certain content. Consequently, it is the first thing on which we must fix our attention if we wish to investigate the origin of our knowledge. Synthesis, generally speaking, is, as we shall afterwards see, the mere operation of the imagination, a blind but indispensable function of the soul, without which we should have no cognition whatever, but of the working of which we are seldom even conscious. But to reduce this synthesis to conceptions is a function of the understanding by means of which we attain to cognition, in the proper meaning of the term. Pure synthesis, represented generally, gives us the pure conception of the understanding. But by this pure synthesis, I mean that which rests upon a basis of a priori synthetical unity. Thus our numeration, and this is more observable in large numbers, is a synthesis according to conceptions, because it takes place according to a common basis of unity, for example the decade. By means of this conception, therefore, the unity in the synthesis of the manifold becomes necessary. By means of analysis, different representations are brought under one conception, an operation of which general logic treats. On the other hand, the duty of transcendental logic is to reduce to conceptions, not representations, but the pure synthesis of representations. The first thing which must be given to us for the sake of the a priori cognition of all objects is the diversity of the pure intuition. The synthesis of this diversity by means of the imagination is the second, but this gives as yet no cognition. The conceptions which give unity to this pure synthesis, and which consist solely in the representation of this necessary synthetical unity, furnish the third requisite for the cognition of an object, and these conceptions are given by the understanding. The same function which gives unity to the different representation in a judgment gives also unity to the mere synthesis of different representations in an intuition, and this unity we call the pure conception of the understanding. Thus, the same understanding, and by the same operations whereby in conceptions by means of analytical unity it produced the logical form of a judgment, introduces, by means of the synthetical unity of the manifold in intuition, a transcendental content into its representations, on which account they are called pure conceptions of the understanding, and they apply a priori to objects, a result not within the power of general logic. In this manner there arise exactly so many pure conceptions of the understanding applying a priori to objects of intuition in general as there are logical functions in all possible judgments. For there is no other function or faculty existing in the understanding besides those enumerated in that table. These conceptions we shall, with Aristotle, call categories, our purpose being originally identical with his, notwithstanding the great difference in the execution. Table of the Categories. 1. Of quantity, unity, plurality, totality. 2. Of quality, reality, negation, limitation. 3. Of relation, of inherence and subsistence, substantia et accidens, of causality and dependence, cause and effect, of community, reciprocity between the agent and patient. 4. Of modality, possibility, impossibility, existence, non-existence, necessity, contingence. This, then, is a catalogue of all the originally pure conceptions of the synthesis which the understanding contains a priori, and these conceptions alone entitle it to be called a pure understanding, inasmuch as only by them it can render the manifold of intuition conceivable, in other words, think an object of intuition. This division is made systematically from a common principle, namely the faculty of judgment, which is just the same as the power of thought, and has not arisen rhapsodically from a search at haphazard after pure conceptions, respecting the full number of which we never could be certain, inasmuch as we employ induction alone in our search, without considering that in this way we can never understand wherefore precisely these conceptions, and none others, abide in the pure understanding. It was a design worthy of an acute thinker like Aristotle to search for these fundamental conceptions. Destitute, however, of any guiding principle, he picked them up just as they occurred to him, and at first hunted out 10, which he called categories, predicaments. Afterwards, he believed that he had discovered 5 others, which were added under the name of post-predicaments. But his catalogue still remained defective. Besides, there are to be found among them some of the modes of pure sensibility, quando, ubi, situs, also prius, simul, and likewise an empirical conception, motus, which can by no means belong to this genealogical register of the pure understanding. Moreover, there are deduced conceptions, axio, passio, enumerated among the original conceptions, and of the latter, some are entirely wanting. With regard to these, it is to be remarked that the categories, as the true primitive conceptions of the pure understanding, have also their pure deduced conceptions, which, in a complete system of transcendental philosophy, must by no means be passed over, though in a merely critical essay we must be contented with the simple mention of the fact. Let it be allowed me to call these pure but deduced conceptions of the understanding, the predicables of the pure understanding in contradistinction to predicaments. If we are in possession of the original and primitive, the deduced and subsidiary conceptions can easily be added, and the genealogical tree of the understanding completely delineated. As my present aim is not to set forth a complete system, but merely the principles of one, I reserve this task for another time. It may be easily executed by anyone who will refer to the ontological manuals and subordinate to the category of causality, for example, the predicables of force, action, passion, to that of community, those of presence and resistance, to the categories of modality, those of origination, extinction, change, and so with the rest. The categories combined with the modes of pure sensibility or with one another afford a great number of deduced a priori conceptions, a complete enumeration of which would be a useful and not unpleasant, but in this place a perfectly dispensable occupation. I purposely omit the definitions of the categories in this treatise. I shall analyze these conceptions only so far as is necessary for the doctrine of method, which is to form a part of this critique. In a system of pure reason, definitions of them would be with justice demanded of me, but to give them here would only hide from our view the main aim of our investigation, at the same time raising doubts and objections, the consideration of which, without injustice to our main purpose, may be very well postponed till another opportunity. Meanwhile, it ought to be sufficiently clear from the little we have already said on this subject that the formation of a complete vocabulary of pure conceptions, accompanied by all the requisite explanations, is not only a possible but an easy undertaking. The compartments already exist. It is only necessary to fill them up, and a systematic topic like present indicates with perfect precision the proper place to which each conception belongs, while it readily points out any that have not yet been filled up. SS 7. Our table of the categories suggests considerations of some importance which may perhaps have significant results in regard to the scientific form of all rational cognitions. For that this table is useful in the theoretical part of philosophy, nay, indispensable for the sketching of the complete plan of a science, so far as that science rests upon conceptions a priori, and for dividing it mathematically according to fixed principles, is most manifest from the fact that it contains all the elementary conceptions of the understanding, nay, even the form of a system of these in the understanding itself, and consequently indicates all the momenta, and also the internal arrangement of a projected speculative science, as I have elsewhere shown. Footnote, in the Metaphysical Principles of Natural Science. Here follow some of these observations. 1. This table, which contains four classes of conceptions of the understanding, may, in the first instance, be divided into two classes, the first of which relates to objects of intuition, pure as well as empirical, the second to the existence of these objects either in relation to one another or to the understanding. The former of these classes of categories I would entitle the mathematical, and the latter the dynamical categories. The former, as we see, has no correlates. These are only to be found in the second class. This difference must have a ground in the nature of the human understanding. 2. The number of the categories in each class is always the same, namely 3, a fact which also demands some consideration, because in all other cases division a priori through conceptions is necessarily dichotomy. It is to be added that the third category in each triad always arises from the combination of the second with the first. Thus, totality is nothing else but plurality contemplated as unity. Limitation is merely reality conjoined with negation. Community is the causality of a substance reciprocally determining and determined by other substances. And finally, necessity is nothing but existence, which is given through the possibility itself. Let it not be supposed, however, that the third category is merely a deduced and not a primitive conception of the pure understanding. For the conjunction of the first and second, in order to produce the third conception, requires a particular function of the understanding, which is by no means identical with those which are exercised in the first and second. Thus, the conception of a number which belongs to the category of totality is not always possible where the conceptions of multitude and unity exist, for example, in the representation of the infinite. Or if I conjoin the conception of a cause with that of a substance, it does not follow that the conception of influence, that is, how one substance can be the cause of something in another substance, will be understood from that. Thus, it is evident that a particular act of the understanding is here necessary, and so in the other instances. 3. With respect to one category, namely that of community, which is found in the third class, it is not so easy as with the others to detect its accordance with the form of the disjunctive judgment which corresponds to it in the table of the logical functions. In order to assure ourselves of this accordance, we must observe that in every disjunctive judgment, the sphere of the judgment, that is, the complex of all that is contained in it, is represented as a whole divided into parts, And since one part cannot be contained in the other, they are cogitated as coordinated with, not subordinated to each other, so that they do not determine each other unilaterally, as in a linear series, but reciprocally, as in an aggregate. If one member of the division is posited, all the rest are excluded, and conversely. Now, a like connection is cogitated in a whole of things. For one thing is not subordinated as effect to another as cause of its existence, but, on the contrary, is coordinated contemporaneously and reciprocally, as a cause in relation to the determination of the others. For example, in a body, the parts of which mutually attract and repel each other. And this is an entirely different kind of connection from that which we find in the mere relation of the cause to the effect, the principle to the consequence. For in such a connection, the consequence does not in its turn determine the principle, and therefore does not constitute, with the latter, a whole, just as the creator does not with the world make up a whole. The process of understanding by which it represents to itself the sphere of a divided conception is employed also when we think of a thing as divisible. And in the same manner as the members of the division in the former exclude one another, and yet are connected in one sphere, so the understanding represents to itself the parts of the latter as having, each of them, an existence as substances, independently of the others, and yet as united in one whole. SS 8. In the transcendental philosophy of the ancients, there exists one more leading division which contains pure conceptions of the understanding, and which, although not numbered among the categories, ought, according to them, as conceptions a priori, to be valid of objects. But in this case, they would augment the number of the categories, which cannot be. These are set forth in the proposition, so renowned among the schoolmen, quod libet ens est, unum verum bonum. Now, though the inferences from this principle were mere tautological propositions, and though it is allowed only by courtesy to retain a place in modern metaphysics, yet a thought which maintained itself for such a length of time, however empty it seems to be, deserves an investigation of its origin, and justifies the conjecture that it must be grounded in some law of the understanding, which, as is often the case, has only been erroneously interpreted. These pretended transcendental predicates are, in fact, nothing but logical requisites and criteria of all cognition of objects, and they employ as the basis for this cognition the categories of quantity, namely unity, plurality, and totality. But these, which must be taken as material conditions, that is, as belonging to the possibility of things themselves, they employed merely in a formal signification, as belonging to the logical requisites of all cognition, and yet most unguardedly changed these criteria of thought into properties of objects, as things in themselves. Now, in every cognition of an object there is unity of conception, which may be called qualitative unity, so far as by this term we understand only the unity in our connection of the manifold. For example, unity on the theme in a play, an oration or a story. Secondly, there is truth in respect of the deductions from it. The more true deductions we have from a given conception, the more criteria of its objective reality. This we might call the qualitative plurality of characteristic marks, which belong to a conception as to a common foundation, but are not cogitated as a quantity in it. Thirdly, there is perfection, which consists in this, that the plurality falls back upon the unity of the conception, and accords completely with that conception and with no other. This we may denominate qualitative completeness. Hence it is evident that these logical criteria of the possibility of cognition are merely the three categories of quantity modified and transformed to suit an unauthorized manner of applying them. That is to say, the three categories in which the unity in the production of the quantum must be homogeneous throughout are transformed solely with a view to the connection of heterogeneous parts of cognition in one act of consciousness by means of the quality of the cognition, which is the principle of that connection. Thus, the criterion of the possibility of a conception, not of its object, is the definition of it, in which the unity of the conception, the truth of all that may be immediately deduced from it, and finally the completeness of what has been thus deduced, constitute the requisites for the reproduction of the whole conception. Thus, also, the criterion or test of an hypothesis is the intelligibility of the received principle of explanation, or its unity, without help from any subsidiary hypothesis. The truth of our deductions from it, consistency with each other and with experience, and lastly, the completeness of the principle of the explanation of these deductions, which refer to neither more nor less than what was admitted in the hypothesis, restoring analytically and a posteriori what was cogitated synthetically and a priori. By the conceptions, therefore, of unity, truth, and perfection, we have made no addition to the transcendental table of the categories, which is complete without them. We have, on the contrary, merely employed the three categories of quantity, setting aside their application to objects of experience as general logical laws of the consistency of cognition with itself. Chapter 2. Of the Deduction of the Pure Conceptions of the Understanding. SS 9. Section 1. Of the Principles of a Transcendental Deduction in General. Teachers of jurisprudence, when speaking of rights and claims, distinguish in a cause the question of right, quid juris, from the question of fact, quid facti, and while they demand proof of both, they give to the proof of the former, which goes to establish right or claim in law, the name of deduction. Now we make use of a great number of empirical conceptions without opposition from anyone, and consider ourselves, even without any attempt at deduction, justified in attaching to them a sense and a superstitious signification, because we have always experience at hand to demonstrate their objective reality. There exist also, however, usurped conceptions such as fortune, fate, which circulate with almost universal indulgence, and yet are occasionally challenged by the question, quid juris? In such cases, we have great difficulty in discovering any deduction for these terms, inasmuch as we cannot produce any manifest ground of right, either from experience or from reason, on which the claim to employ them can be founded. Among the many conceptions which make up the very variegated web of human cognition, some are destined for pure use a priori, independent of all experience, and their title to be so employed always requires a deduction, inasmuch as, to justify such use of them, proofs from experience are not sufficient. But it is necessary to know how these conceptions can apply to objects without being derived from experience. I term, therefore, an examination of the manner in which conceptions can apply a priori to objects the transcendental deduction of conceptions, and I distinguish it from the empirical deduction, which indicates the mode in which conception is obtained through experience and reflection thereon, consequently does not concern itself with the right, but only with the fact of our obtaining conceptions in such and such a manner. We have already seen that we are in possession of two perfectly different kinds of conceptions, which nevertheless agree with each other in this, that they both apply to objects completely a priori. These are the conceptions of space and time as forms of sensibility, and the categories as pure conceptions of the understanding. To attempt an empirical deduction of either of these classes would be labor in vain, because the distinguishing characteristic of their nature consists in this, that they apply to their objects without having borrowed anything from experience towards the representation of them. Consequently, if a deduction of these conceptions is necessary, it must always be transcendental. Meanwhile, with respect to these conceptions, as with respect to all our cognition, we certainly may discover in experience, if not the principle of their possibility, yet the occasioning causes of their production. It will be found that the impressions of sense give the first occasion for bringing into action the whole faculty of cognition, and for the production of experience, which contains two very dissimilar elements, namely a matter for cognition, given by the senses, and a certain form for the arrangement of this matter, arising out of the inner fountain of pure intuition and thought. And these, on occasion given by sensuous impressions, are called into exercise and produce conceptions. Such an investigation into the first efforts of our faculty of cognition to mount from particular perceptions to general conceptions is undoubtedly of great utility, and we have to thank the celebrated Locke for having first opened the way for this inquiry. But a deduction of the pure a priori conceptions, of course, never can be made in this way, seeing that, in regard to their future employment, which must be entirely independent of experience, they must have a far different certificate of birth to show from that of a descent from experience. This attempted physiological derivation, which cannot properly be called deduction, because it relates merely to a quaestio facti, I shall entitle an explanation of the possession of a pure cognition. It is therefore manifest that there can be only a transcendental deduction of these conceptions, and by no means an empirical one. Also, that all attempts at an empirical deduction, in regard to pure a priori conceptions, are in vain, and can only be made by one who does not understand the altogether peculiar nature of these cognitions. But although it is admitted that the only possible